Happy New Year, everyone. I'm Timothy Martin, and welcome to another episode of GFOA's Finance Fridays. Today, we travel to Canada, our friendly neighboring country up north, for a light and casual conversation with Dean Rear, General Manager of Financial Services and Chief Financial Officer with the Metro Vancouver Regional District. Growing up in Alberta at the foothills of the Rockies on a mixed farm of crops and beef cattle, Dean describes his childhood as a boy life with miles of open space to ride dirt bikes and play hockey. In case you don't know, Canadians take their hockey pretty seriously, and it took about 8 minutes into the conversation for the subject to come up. He began playing at age 5 and still participates in weekly games to unwind from a busy day in the office. In Canada, every small little town has an ice rink in their community. Dean feels success of teams can be best understood through the metaphor of hockey. To be successful, you must understand your role. A father of two girls, Dean recounts a highlight of fatherhood by traveling to Japan to hike to the top of Mount Fuji with his eldest. As his daughter led the way, checking in on her father's progression, Dean had an epiphany of the changing role of his parental journey. He feels we can all lean into this understanding as we coach and mentor the younger employees on our teams. As a fellow Lego nut, I appreciated talking to Dean about his building passion. He's currently working through the Millennium Falcon from Star Wars. We had a lot of fun with him and hope you enjoy your time with him as well. Let's listen in. Dean is coming to us from Canada, where he grew up. Great to have you here, Dean. When I think of Canada, I think of mountains and snow. Is that what you experienced as a kid?
Very much so. Where I grew up in Alberta, right in the foothills of the Rocky Mountains there, I had great views of mountains, and many of them have snow on them year round. Now that I live out here in the lower mainland of British Columbia and in the Vancouver area, a lot of mountains and a lot of them carry snow on them year round as well too. So very much what you're thinking of is a fair part of the reality, especially here in Western Canada.
So you got to be a big fan of snow, obviously.
I am a big fan of snow. However, I will say that there's a reason why I moved to the West Coast. And you know, after a certain amount of time, you kind of get tired of shoveling it. So now it's just dealing with the rain and so on, like you'd see in Seattle.
Is putting chains on tires, is that still a thing?
It is very much still a thing. Definitely for the trucks that transport so many of the goods across the country, but also as well too, in many of the areas in the interior of British Columbia and up in the north as well too, there are some pretty challenging roads, and chaining up is quite often a requirement.
So tell us a little bit about family life. Growing up as a kid, you've got the mountains there, you've got the snow there. What was life like for you in those early years?
Life for me was very much kind of like what you would call a boy's life, I guess, if you will. I mean, I grew up out in the country, so lots of wide open spaces, lots of camping and fishing and riding my dirt bike along through the country. Just a really great opportunity to sort of have the freedom to explore and do. In later life, I had many people say to me, well, how did you actually make friends? I mean, your nearest neighbor is miles and miles away and so on, right? And you know, it was hard to get out, and, you know, playing with the neighborhood kids was a bit of an excursion. You know, it was a really great way to grow up, having that freedom to explore and be out in the natural areas. That's something I think has always really stuck with me, and I have an appreciation for being able to have that type of a lifestyle.
Well, who needs friends when you can ride a dirt bike all around the mountains in Canada? you know, that had to be, I'm just picturing that. It had to be a great experience growing up as a kid. You mentioned, you told us farm life, I guess, was a big part of growing up too. We've had a number of guests on the podcast since we started this that have kind of grown up on the farm. You're no exception to that. What's farming like in Canada? Any different than here in the U.S.?
I would expect it would be very similar to what you would see in the Midwest area in Wisconsin and so on. It's mixed farming. It's both crops and cattle, primarily beef cattle. And a lot of the work was about harvesting and haying and doing all that and moving and feeding cattle and so on. So I would expect it would be very similar. I think I find when I travel, whenever I run into someone from the Midwest, from Wisconsin, Minnesota, there is a bit of a connection to those folks just because of the same type of geography and the same type of familiarity with that type of lifestyle.
Did you enjoy that type of lifestyle? I mean, you have the adventure, there's that aspect of it, but there's also kind of, I guess, the hardworking part of a farm. Did you have to do all of that?
I did enjoy it. I mean, I was driving tractors and grain trucks and so on when I was, you know, 11, 12, 13 years old, right? And when I look back on that, you know, that was not only a good opportunity for responsibility for me, but it was really great fun as well, too. And there's advantages to that, you know, trying to teach my kids how to drive in the city when they're having to deal with traffic and everything, you're not even understanding how to operate the vehicle before you're dealing with traffic. I never had traffic. I knew how the vehicle worked before I actually even got onto a road. So it was really great. I enjoyed the work. And I think a big part of that was instilling that a bit of an ethic into me as well too, sort of appreciating, you know, what you get with some good effort.
You told us that your uncle, if I'm remembering right, still kind of runs the farm. He's kind of in charge of the farm now.
Yeah.
How has farming changed now versus years ago when you were a kid? Is it tougher? You know, is the money still as good?
Well, what I can say is the biggest change that I've noticed, and I don't want to speak for my uncle or any other farmers, but the biggest change that I've noticed is that there's just so fewer people involved in it now. Like when we would be baling hay, you know, using the small square bales, there would be a number of either hired hands or neighbors collaborating with us to, you know, stoop the hay and stack it up and pile it up and put it into piles, or, you know, proper stacks for the winter. And with the machinery and the technology that's changed in the operation of modern farms, it's so much more less labor intensive, and maybe to a certain extent, I think there's been a bit of a thinning out of the farm communities over the last number of decades.
Yeah, I mean, certainly a challenge there for sure. And I think we see the same thing here in the U.S. Yeah. Yeah, obviously come from a hardworking family. You mentioned that your family, parents in particular, kind of the salt of the earth. For somebody that may not know what that phrase means, explain that and why you say that about your family.
So the way when I say stuff like that, one of the things that I rely on my upbringing for and my family for is when you find yourself in a challenging or sticky situation, having to make a decision about something one way or the other, where does that moral compass come from? And so quite often when I think about that, I pause and I go, okay, so what would my folks think about this, me making this decision, and how would they see this decision? How would my aunts and uncles and all the folks who had an impact on me growing up, how would they see that decision being made by myself? You know, would they see me making the right decision, a tough decision, nonetheless, whatever? But how would they receive that? And so I use that as a bit of a moral compass. In my day-to-day working life.
I think that's really good advice. And a lot of people, I mean, I was, when you were saying that, I was thinking, have I done that? Have I ever done that? Maybe not routinely, but yeah, certainly good advice there. I do want to note though, that we've maybe been talking a few minutes, but we haven't even heard the word hockey yet, which I think is surprising. Are you a big, I assume you're a pretty big hockey fan or hockey player?
Yeah, absolutely. I just played last night. I still play year round, mostly twice a week. I've been playing since I was about 5 years old. I'm a huge fan. It is the absolute best game. And yes, we take a bit of ownership of it as Canadians, but one of the things I really love is how the game is growing in other countries. And it doesn't surprise me. There is nothing like getting out and moving on the ice and just feeling the wind on your face and how the speed works and so on. It's just the best game. It's just the best game. And by the way, I will say, I am so appreciative that you didn't say ice hockey, because
I almost did.
There is one hockey.
Well, so you said you started when you were five. So, you know, people where I live, you know, we go to a center where there is a rink inside that you play hockey on. I imagine when you grew up, was it just on frozen lakes, or, you know, you played outdoors as friends?
We had a bit of a combination. And so I was I came at this at an age when, you know, I still had organized games on outdoor rinks. And yes, I have played hockey on lakes. But mostly it was in indoor arenas like you would have at your community centers and so on as well. Almost every small little town on the prairies in Canada has an ice rink, which has been to a large extent the real focal point for Canadian communities.
I would imagine hockey is also great, you know, team building, and it really brings, you know, close-knit friends together too.
Absolutely. There's something to be learned about understanding your role when you're playing on a team, and that's the same for all sports. But in order to have team success, everyone's got to play a bit of a role, and that was really great for me to really start to understand that. For the team to succeed, I need to do my best, and I need to be totally aware of what my actions are going to be in terms of consequence for the overall team. Okay, so you know what my last name is, right? It's Rear. So you put that on the back of a hockey jersey, and you go around the prairies playing hockey. You can only imagine the amount of trash talking that you get. Well, I could have spent a lot of time sitting in the penalty box. So you have to learn to have a thick skin, because you don't want to put your team in a compromised situation.
So you mentioned the penalty box. I mean, did you ever get in any fights on the ice? It doesn't look like I'd want to take you out on the ice. I mean, it looks like, you know, our listeners can't see you, but you look like you'd be pretty feisty on the ice.
I don't recall any fights.
I don't know if I believe that, but I'm not going to press you on it. So you've got, we've talked about the adventure. We've talked about the farm life and the family, and there's also school involved, going to school in Canada. What was that like in those later years, middle school, high school, as you're kind of, I think you told us that you had a really small class, maybe 50 or less people that you graduated with. Kind of talk us through that whole school experience.
Well, in many ways, I would expect elementary school to be very similar to what you've experienced in the U.S. as well, too. And where I grew up, we didn't have a middle school. We went straight from elementary school into the high school, which was grades 8 to 12. And it was a very small school. There was only about 200 students in grade 8 to 12. And so my graduating class, which was the biggest at the time, only had 44 students in grade 12. And so we were all bused. The high school was not in the town. It was in between the two towns. Someone had decided that halfway in the middle would be a good way to go. And so we were all bused there. So it was a lot of riding in the bus. Anytime we wanted to go anywhere in terms of if we were playing sports or anything, it was a long bus ride. But you know, the folks that were there, the teachers that were there, very dedicated to what they were doing. And I had a really positive experience going through high school. I will not say I was the best student. I noted in the piece that I had done for you folks that, you know, I was neither a class clown nor did I stand out academically, but I wasn't a bother for anyone as well either. So,
well, I mean, who has time for homework when you're, you know, riding the dirt bike and playing hockey and all of that stuff?
Exactly, right? That's what I told my parents.
So I guess that kind of goes into the mindset of what were students, you know, in your class thinking? I mean, you're going to graduate, obviously, at some point. What did most students do? And what were you looking at your path of doing when you got to that point?
So in my area, so many of the folks, of the students were from family farms. So many of them had a role to play on their family farm post-graduation. So they were going to be farmers. And also in our area is a big area for oil and gas. And so there were a lot that went into the oil and gas business. And that's what I initially did after high school. I wasn't exactly sure where I wanted to go and what I wanted to do. I had absolutely loved the way that I grew up, but I just knew that it wasn't the way that I wanted to grow old. But it takes a little time for a lot of people to try and figure out exactly where they want to go and how exactly to start that journey.
You know, that's an interesting comment. You know, I love the way I grew up, but it's not the way I want to grow old. I've never heard that quote before. Explain that a little bit more.
Well, like we've talked about, I mean, I had I don't want to say idyllic, but I had a really good upbringing and with so many good opportunities to be a boy and do boy things and have great experiences. But I kind of got to the point where I wanted to, you know, sort of see more and be more part of a larger world that just wasn't available to me from where I was growing up. I'm not exactly certain exactly where that thinking came from. I've got a couple of different ideas, but I started to really understand that I wanted to get out and about and do something different. And so then determining how you want to grow old, you start to see and have experiences and have interactions with people that make you think about other things that you weren't thinking about before. One of the examples I had was working in the oil patch. One of the vice presidents from the oil company in Calgary came out, and it was someone that I saw that was providing direction, whereas the rest of us were all there receiving direction. And I started to think about, that might be a good role to be in, the one that's saying how things are done as opposed to undertaking orders from someone else. Yeah. And so you start thinking that way.
And that job, you know, that was a very manually intensive job, it sounds like. So walk, you know, give us paint a picture for us of what's a work day like. It's got to be pretty cold, I would imagine.
Well, our weather, I would say, is probably not dissimilar to that of, say, Colorado as well, too, right? You get very, very hot summers and you get very, very cold winters. And so for the people that work in oil and gas, there is a lot of outside work. And so you're dealing with extremes on both sides. But I clearly remember being in the winter, and it was like minus 30, minus 40, and I was doing some pipe fitting. So you're threading pipe and so on and so forth. And I was young enough to realize that, I was young enough to think that I could do this without any problems, but old enough to realize that I didn't want to do that as I got older and older and older. And as the body starts to break down. So that was when I really started thinking hard about moving on and going back to school and going to university.
I don't know how how do your arms and legs function in minus 30 degree weather? Did you ever get frostbite?
No, I've never had frostbite. I mean, you take the proper precautions, the gloves and the proper clothing and so on, and you can take care of yourself pretty good. And if it gets too cold, you jump back into the truck, which is, you know, when in that kind of weather, always running and warm yourself up and then get out and do it again.
Dean mentioned wanting to go to college now. We'll touch on that after the break. So before the break, we were talking about your experiences, in this oil industry, oil and gas industry. And I think you said you saw kind of somebody higher up that came out and a different side of working. And that certainly piqued your interest and kind of got you thinking about, you know, hey, maybe I want to do something different. And then college entered your mind, right?
Yeah, you bet. Yeah, so I realized that, like I said, to have a life different from the one that I had grown up with, I would have to go to college and university. And you know, I think there's a lot of pressure on kids these days to want to know or to have to know exactly what it is that they need to do when they go to university and so on. It is so expensive, and everyone's worried about, you know, the costs and false starts and so on. But for almost all of us, we need to figure out this journey ourselves. And so I headed to college, not really with a clear plan, but knowing that I wanted to do something and did some upgrading. And then I started into a computer science program and did my first couple of years in computer science. And while I found it very interesting, I did come to realize that was probably not exactly what I wanted to do going forward. And I can actually quite clearly remember the moment when that happened is we were in a co-op program. I'd come to the University of Victoria in British Columbia here on the island and was doing a co-op work term placement at an employer. And they had an exit interview and I had spent almost 4 months of the work term primarily by myself, coding and so on and so forth. And I said, well, you know, it would have been a nice to have a little bit more interaction with other staff and other team members and so on. And the response to that comment was, well, that's what we do with UIT guys. We put you in a corner and let you do your work. And so I kind of realized at that point in time that wasn't exactly what I wanted out of a career. I wanted interaction. And I know it probably seems strange, but going into economics and accounting was a place where I found a lot of interaction.
Yeah. How do you come to that decision though for economics and accounting? I mean, how do you get there from IT and was that ever anything you thought about growing up?
Well, so with the connections that were there from my time in oil and gas, I got a summer job in Calgary at the oil company. And so I ended up doing a lot of, you know, accounts payable type of work and coding of invoices and matching and helping out in payroll and that sort of thing. And there was a manager there who was a chartered accountant, and chartered accountant in Canada. I mean, now we call ourselves CPAs, but that's very similar to your CPA program down in the US. So he was one that talked to me about accounting as a career and piqued my interest. And he was very open about it that, you know what, you go down this road and doors will open up and there's going to be many, many opportunities for you to pursue when it comes out of this, because there's a very good basic grounding through the accounting programs that will allow you to pursue many different paths. And that was something that very much appealed to me. Again, I was still not exactly sure where this was going to go, where I was going to go. But knowing that there was options was very appealing.
So you said you started articling there.
Yeah.
But there, it sounds like there was a moment where you kind of knew that this was going to be your journey and this was what you wanted to do.
You know, that's a really good question, because I always try and look back and figure out if there was an exact moment of when, and I'm not certain that I can actually pinpoint one for
you. Well, I'm only saying that because you wrote that to us, Dean. You said, knowing that this would be your journey, the job I envisioned. why is that?
It was the possibilities. At the time, I was very much interested in things like entrepreneurship. And being someone that didn't have a lot of means, how do you become an entrepreneur? How do you get business experience? And so the CA program offered me the opportunity to try and get that business experience, because the articling process with an accounting firm, you go in and you work with businesses on their internal controls and so on. So you get that really good understanding. So that's what I saw as my opportunity to try and get into a business and get a good understanding of what business was like, knowing that what I felt was at some time I might get into business on my own and or become an entrepreneur of some sort, right?
How long were you there, you know, in I guess the private sector before you made the jump to public sector? Because you didn't go into business on your own. You eventually made a jump to the public sector. So how long did were you in that job before this happened?
I was working in accounting firms for about 6 years before I went into the public sector for the first time. And that was with the Office of the Auditor General of Canada. And it was a bit of a natural fit. The skill set was very transferable, because the Auditor General does very similar work to what the accounting firms did. It's just that there was captive clients with the various federal government and the federal government's crown corporations. And I worked out of the Vancouver office, and we primarily did our work for the Yukon territorial government. So I was up in Whitehorse a lot, auditing the crown corporations and the territorial government there. So it was a bit of a fairly natural move going from public accounting into a public sector auditing and accounting, if you will.
Was it something that you saw yourself doing long term once you got in there?
No. What I really appreciated was the opportunity to get into much, much bigger entities and organizations. And I joined the office of the OAG just before Y2K, and there was a huge amount of work that was going on, as we all felt that there was going to be challenges with systems, you know, turning over from 1999 to 2000 and so on. I really saw it as an opportunity to gain more experience with bigger entities. And I didn't at the time think it was going to lead to a long-term public sector career. But I really started to enjoy the sector. And that's when I started looking at other opportunities with local government.
And you did. You went through a few more municipalities before landing where you're at now, yeah. Metro Vancouver. Did each time you kind of work your way up the ladder?
Yes. So this is what I'll say about my career progression through the municipalities. Have you ever heard of the book, What Got You Here Won't Get You There? And I will admit that I have actually never read the book. But the title has really resonated with me. So whenever I've come into a new role, so I'm starting a new role, so I leave the office of the Auditor General and I go to one of our member municipalities, and I'm in that role. And while I'm there and I'm learning and getting used to a whole different sector and a whole different set of services provided, I'm always thinking about, okay, so what's next? Where would I like to go next? And what I came to realize is that where you want to go next quite often requires a different set of skills, a different focus than what you have now. And so you have to continually evaluate and work on the skills that you are going to have to make the next move. One of the things that I try to tell our staff here in our finance department now is, like, when nobody's here, whose office do you go into and look around and say, yeah, I think I'd like to be in here? And then ask yourself what it is that you need to know and understand in order to get in there. And so as I kind of work through this a bit, that's really what I started to focus on. You get into a new role, learn it, do it well, but always think about where the next one is and what it is that you're going to have to know to get you there.
And in accounting, we all know that you've got to know a lot, and that information changes quite a bit. Do you talk about the differences of accounting for local government in Canada? And, you know, if you're familiar with kind of accounting local government in the U.S., policies, procedures, you know, are there different rules, different standards that you have to abide by? And would you rather have some of the rules and standards that we have in the U.S.?
Well, I won't say that I'm terribly familiar with all of the rules and standards that you have in the U.S., but for the most part, there is a lot of similarities between what I would say the accounting and disclosure requirements for local governments here as there are in the U.S. We have different bodies that prescribe those rules, but I know they all work together to try and evaluate issues and make similar recommendations for how things are treated and how transactions are treated. One of the things that I will say that is different as you progress in this role is it really moves away from the accounting and financial reporting side into that budget and financial planning side. Your elected officials are interested in where things are going and not necessarily where they've been. And so it was that move to that financial planning piece that really started to be one of those things that I knew I had to understand if I wanted to get to where I was wanting to be.
As you worked your way kind of, you know, through different jobs and you know, to different positions and up the ladder, so to speak, you told us something that I think some people do, others may not do in their careers, but I think it certainly makes sense. And that's kind of building business relationships with people that you're working with. Explain why that's important.
Oh, this is absolutely critical. So in this business that we're in local government, there's always going to be issues that you have with your counterparts in other departments, with the engineers, with the planners, in terms of financial capacity, budget, dealing with different issues. What you can't have happen is going into a meeting to deal with an issue and not have a relationship with the people that you are going to deal with. You need to have that relationship and have an understanding of the perspectives that they have on things and how they think about things before you get into dealing with issues. So I've always tried to make it a bit of a habit that when I come into an organization, take the time to get to know people, go have the coffee chats and get to know them, understand their backgrounds, understand kind of where their perspectives are on very broad issues. And so that you've got that first name basis relationship when you actually have to sit down and say, look, I appreciate you want to do this kind of stuff, but your budget is just not within our boundaries that we can do this year. So we're going to have to make some changes. How do you want to work through that? Because if you start out that way, it's going to be a confrontational piece.
No, totally, absolutely makes sense. There's also an experience that you had with your daughter that kind of has helped in as you're looking at staff members in your office, and that involved going back to the mountains. Yes. Walk us through that.
No, absolutely. So, my oldest daughter was spending some time in Australia and New Zealand, and she was going to be heading back, and we'd been corresponding, and she wanted to meet me somewhere and do a bit of traveling together. The two of us travel quite well together. And so she said, "Well, why don't we meet in Japan? We'll meet in Tokyo, and we'll go climb Mount Fuji." And so I totally bit into that. And so just a few years ago, this happened, and we met in Tokyo, and we got a guide, and we got up very, very early, and headed out to start up Mount Fuji, and then got partway up, and they put you to sleep. You not put you to sleep, but. But what they there's various stops along the way, and so you get some rest, get a few hours sleep, and then you start climbing in the dark again to go up to Mount Fuji, because what you want to do is see the sunrise off the top of the mountain. And so what happened there for me is my daughter at the time was about 25 years old, and this was the first time where she was taking the lead. She was always in the front. She was always the one that was turning back to me and say, "Dad, you're all right. Dad, you need a breath. Dad, you need to, take a moment. How are your knees doing?" And it was a realization for me that this was when sort of we were changing the roles. For 25 years, I had been the one that was in the front, taking the lead, taking care, and she was the one making that doing that role now. And so when I look at the younger staff that we have in our office now, what I have to think about with them is they are looking to have those same opportunities, and it has to be really incumbent upon myself to both provide those opportunities, but know when to step back and allow them to take the lead. It is sometimes just a little bit too easy to look at the younger folks in an organization or in society and draw conclusions that, they work differently. So it's something less. It's not. It's just different. And you have to accept that and understand that the way they do things can be very, very creative and very, very productive. So it was a really good experience for me and really enlightening. And yes, it was my daughter, but I tend to see so many of those good traits in young people these days.
Yeah, I can imagine that's going to be a memories that will last a lifetime. Planning any more big hikes that we should know about?
Not anything right now. My oldest one currently lives in the UK, and when we do get over there, we do try to do a little bit of hiking and biking and so on, but nothing of a milestone nature.
All right. Well, kind of going back to kind of working through different jobs in the public sector, I know there was a uh-oh moment that you kind of thought about, which kind of involved meeting with the public and things maybe not going so well, and that kind of opened your eyes up a little bit.
Oh, absolutely, yes. So in my first foray into a municipality, the council at the time had gone through a bit of a period of austerity, and they had wanted to look at what their remuneration was. And so the council at the time asked the finance department to conduct a public meeting and go out and receive comments and report back on increasing council remuneration. And so this was my very first experience at a public meeting with members of the public. And so we advertised it, and we had a meeting room set up where they could come and meet. And it was myself and my boss that were there to essentially our mandate was to listen, provide the information on this proposed increase to remuneration, and listen. And so what I experienced is how passionate the public or certain components of the public can be when it comes to issues like remuneration of elected officials, because there was a shouting and people jumping up to their feet and pointing of fingers and so on. And I remember sitting there thinking, oh my goodness, what have I got myself into? will we actually get out alive? I don't know.
It's from all that, all those highs from playing hockey and fighting. That's what it's from.
Well, yeah, but you know what? Those people that attend those meetings in Canada, they play hockey too. So, it all went well, but it was quite revealing about the passion that people will have about public sector issues. And I know elected official remuneration can be a bit of a lightning rod sometimes, but it also provided me with a beginning of an appreciation, I think, of those that really value the public sector services and pay attention to that. It's very easy to dismiss that sometimes, but I do have a real appreciation for the members of the public that stay involved in local issues.
Well, and it's public engagement, and you know, here in the U.S., local governments all across this country are struggling with public engagement on a local government level. GFOA has started a rethinking public engagement initiative to try to, you know, try to bring some new tools to the table. And you can, of course, those listening, find out more about that on our website, gfoa.org. But what is public engagement like where you are and in local governments there? Do you struggle to get people to participate, to bring in new younger people to participate?
I think the short answer is yes, we do struggle. We're experiencing the same things that you are as well, in terms of engagement of the public. And also as well, I think too, for us, for Metro Vancouver, as a regional government, we are not front and center with taxpayers and ratepayers. We provide the treatment plant services for water and liquid waste and so on. And so we're not front and center with folks. And so we run a little bit under the radar. But what we are really working hard to try and do is get people to understand the importance of these services. Just as an example, we've been going through a period of drought in our area here, and so our water reservoirs are down much lower than they normally would be in October. Normally we'd be rainy like Seattle, and we'd have lots of water in the reservoirs, but we're not. But people need to understand how important the basics of water and liquid waste services are to the prosperity of a region. If you do not have those things, you don't have anything upon which you can build the prosperity of a region with other initiatives and other things. So this is really important. So one of our key goals with the things that we do is to try to tell people how important these things are, and do not take them for granted. They are at a very, very low cost relatively. So sometimes you can overlook it, but they're very important services to have. And if you don't have them, people really notice. There's nothing like a boil water advisory that gets people's attention, right? So we've done a lot more in the last couple of years, both from a social media perspective, but also to just getting out in person. The Pacific National Exhibition in Vancouver, you know, attended by over a million people every year. We've got a very big display there with all, you know, examples of our infrastructure and what it is that we do. And people really appreciate understanding all that.
You mentioned Metro Vancouver, the regional district. You're the CFO there. So what's life like as CFO, as you've worked your way up and gotten to this point?
What's life like? Well, okay. So I got to say,
it's a broad question.
You are catching me at a time. We just did our full board budget workshop here a couple of days ago. So I've got these budget blinders on. And so that's largely what I've been thinking about the last little while. It's just our budget for 2023 and our financial plan going forward. What life is like for me is, I've got a great team of colleagues, the other general managers and my CAO, that have an excellent understanding of the challenges that the region is facing and the work that has to be done to continue to provide those services. We've got a lot of big infrastructure projects that we are working on and that we're going to have to figure out how we finance. And that is a great part of what I spend my time doing, is working with those teams to help understand what the costs are, what is the timing of it, how are we going to fund it, how are the taxpayers going to pay for it, is there opportunities for partnership with senior levels of government to provide some of these services if it achieves some of those goals. And what I will say too, I think in the last 3 years, yes, we've been through a pandemic, but also we've seen torrential rain events with atmospheric rivers that have caused flooding in our area, and heat domes that have caused severe heat. And so the impacts of climate change are really causing us to think about how we build and put together infrastructure that's meant to last 100 years. So
you mentioned going through the pandemic, and on season one of the podcast, we talked with a number of guests as we were kind of in the height of the pandemic and what their offices face. Haven't really talked to anybody from another country like Canada and how the pandemic impacted workforce there. What was office life like in Canada during the pandemic?
Our organization before the pandemic did not have any type of remote work or working from home policy or approach. And probably like many other organizations, within 3 days, everybody was gone. And for the better part of 2 years, it was working from home for all of those that could do so. So most of the folks in head office managed to pivot, and in many cases, it worked really, really well. Those that deal with a lot of transactional things and processing things, that all can be done from home. I didn't see the payroll team for like 6 months, and they're able to deal with it, and they did a great job of it. But where it gets challenging is when you've got issues that you have to resolve and you want to get together and be creative. That doesn't work so well in a virtual environment. And the other challenge that we have is just with an organization like ours, we have a lot of workers that are outside workers, and work from home was not an option for them. So they still have to come in. And so one of the challenges that we face is just sort of, you know, making sure that all of our employees are treated equally, even though some are required to come into work because they work outside, they have to go to a job site and they have to fix things. And those of us that can work from home. So that there is a balance that has to be struck there with that. And I guess the other challenge that I'll say too is with our plants, like our water plants and liquid waste plants, making sure that we had protocols for the teams so that we didn't take out an entire team that was operating a plant, one of their shifts, right? When those services stop, that's problematic for the residents of the region.
Is recruitment and retention a challenge? We're hearing from GFOA members in our member community that, you know, they're losing employees. They're not getting the type of talent pools because others are offering better options, better work options, the remote access, the hybrid opportunities. Are you seeing a challenge in attracting new employees to the field?
Absolutely. All across local government. And one of the things that I will say is a challenge for here in the Lower Mainland is the cost of housing is very, very significant. And so for us to try and recruit, we're essentially competing for a fairly fixed number of people, because it's really hard to attract people to come to the region. Because if they sell a home, they will not get the same home for the same price when they move to the region. So we face that hurdle as well. And also with work from home options, I think we've done a pretty good job of trying to address that. But in the private sector, a lot of them allow work from home, but you don't have to be anywhere near the entity that you're working for. When you work for a local government, it's, you know, from our perspective, you should at least live in the region that you are serving.
Right.
And so we've come into some challenges like that as well, where people have these expectations that, well, you know what, I'm going to join Metro Vancouver, but I'm going to work from Saskatchewan or something like that. And I just don't think that's right for the folks that you are providing the services for the region.
So what's the future hold for you? Are you content kind of where you are and happy with life?
I am content where I am. I'm happy with life. Like I was saying a couple of minutes ago, we have so many challenges that we're facing and infrastructure that needs to be built, that this is a very interesting time. And what I really like having those challenges facing me. They're not easy. I don't have all the solutions, but I really like having the problem to solve. I just feel that with our organization and what we do, we're an impactful organization for the region. But with all these things that are going on, I feel it's a really great time to be part of this organization. One of the things that I really like doing is on Disney Plus, is watching these shows about the creation of Disneyland or the creation of Lucasfilm, and how there's a bit of a forming that was going on, and how the people, you know, looking back, were so excited that they were part of that. When those things were being built and all that creativity was happening. And although I can't say that Metro Vancouver is like Disney or Lucasfilm or anything like that, but you got to feel excited about the things that you're doing. And to be involved at a time when there's so many great challenges to work on, it's just really good to be here. And sometimes you get into that mindset where you don't really want to go because you want to, you know, you don't want to miss something.
You also, I think, have people work with in the organization that are out in on the front lines in the field working and doing the hard work, which you were at that, you know, when you got out of school, you've had that manual labor experience. By having that experience, does it give you a better understanding of what some of these other workers go through when they're out in the fields?
Absolutely. And I one of the things I really like to do is to get out to our plants and get a tour of if they've got a new system or if they've got a new facility at one of the plants going on. And I think that they appreciate that I've got a little bit of that background. I used to wear a hard hat. I used to get my hands dirty and so on. And yes, I'm from head office, and yes, I'm about the money, but I've worked to try and have a bit of a relatability to the people that are actually on the front lines doing the work.
So as we kind of begin to wrap up the podcast, what's family life like? We know the daughter that you hiked the mountain with. I think you got another daughter, right?
Sorry about that. I cut you off there.
Oh no, you're fine. Go ahead.
I've got two daughters, and like I said, the oldest one lives in the UK, and the youngest one lives in the Lower Mainland here, and. They are 26 and 29, and so we are largely empty nesters, my wife and myself now, and my wife is very artistic and very creative, does a lot of quilting and fabric art, that is her thing now, and so I like to say that I live in a quilt factory. I quite often come to work and I've got threads hanging on my suit. There's a lot of things that I would like to have more time for, this role does consume a heck of a lot, and so sometimes the best I do is I get out and play hockey a couple times a week, hopefully at some point in time there's going to be an opportunity to explore some other hobbies in retirement, but until then.
I would imagine playing hockey now feels a little bit different than it did when you were a kid. You can feel it a little different in the bones maybe the next morning.
It feels different, and one of the things that that we all agree to is with our hockey group is if you're injured, never come out and watch because it'll be unbelievably slow. And you come into the dressing room and you go, "Am I as slow as you guys when I'm out there?" Yes, yes, you are. You are as slow as us. So it's slower and sorer.
So you also have another hobby, I guess, and that would be building Legos. Am I right?
Yes, I love Lego. When I was a kid, I used to do all those models that you put together with the glue and everything like that, and those were fun. But a few years ago, started doing a lot more Lego. There's a lot of the little kits that you can do. I like the cars. I like lots of the little Star Wars pieces. And then we got into the pandemic, and I thought, you know what? I need something to do. So I ordered the Millennium Falcon, and which is 7,500 pieces. And I think the manual to put it together is about 500 pages. And so I'm about halfway through that right now. I don't get at it as often as I would like, but it occupies a big portion of our dining room table. So anytime we have a Thanksgiving dinner or a Christmas dinner or whatever, I'm having to move the Millennium Falcon to somewhere else so that we can actually have people over and serve. So it's a good hobby. It's a good fun, and it's a good way to kind of clear your mind of all the challenges that you have.
I don't know if you've seen the 90th anniversary castle that they came out with, but I've got that ordered. I'm excited to build this huge castle. And I think you're right. A lot of adults during the pandemic kind of went back to kind of, you know, playing with Legos and those types of things, and really, you know, seeing more of that. So that's a lot of, you know, you were commenting, I've got Legos here. What's your favorite Lego set?
My favorite one that I've done was a car. It was the McLaren Senna.
Ah, yeah.
So I like Formula One racing, and Ayrton Senna was a star, and it's a really beautiful kit. I really like that one.
Dean and I should do a podcast about Formula One. Huge Formula One fan as well. So yeah, absolutely.
Totally into it.
Yeah, and they're here in the U.S. They're in Austin, coming up. So yeah. Excited about that. So we typically, I know we've been having fun talking about Legos. We could have a whole hour-long conversation about Legos, but we typically ask our guests a couple other fun questions before we wrap up the podcast. So are you ready for that?
Absolutely.
So we've been talking about hiking, what's a bucket list hike for you?
The West Coast Trail.
And explain that a little bit for me. How high is that? Is that a big challenge?
I would say it's not high at all. It goes along the west coast of Vancouver Island, and it's right along the right along sea level there. Oh. And so you're hiking for several days through that area, either from Banfield up or from the Port Alberni area kind of down.
So what was the first car that you had versus the first car that you wanted?
The first car that I had was a 1971 Chevy Bel Air. It was absolutely massive. The first car I wanted was a 1969 Camaro.
How did that big car get around in the snow in Canada?
Oh, awesome. Awesome. Good. I mean, it's so heavy, it just blows through drifts.
Snowplow.
Yeah, exactly.
All right, Dean. Well, thanks for joining us. Great conversation. I certainly enjoyed getting to know you and your story. I know our listeners will as well. And to our listeners, thank you for listening. We'll talk again on the next Finance Fridays.
You've been listening to Finance Fridays, a GFOA production. This podcast was produced by Dan Zielinski. Our conversation was hosted by Timothy Martin. The original theme music for Finance Fridays was composed by David Cronister. If you like what you heard, be sure to subscribe, rate, and review your experience. New episodes will release on Fridays. I'm Chris Morrill, the Executive Director of GFOA. We appreciate you joining us.